This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. There is a very important story on the Bloomberg today by our Max Abelson, who tracks the comings and goings of Wall Street firms, including its slow moves to recruit from black colleges, Tim.
Well, we're lucky to have Max Abelson, finance reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us live in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Max, I think it's important to start with where these Wall Street banks were a little over a year ago after the murder of George Floyd at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement, when we were seeing so much play out in the media, and these companies were being called on to be held liable for recruiting more from black colleges and universities. So where were we a year ago?
It was such a dramatic moment, and it's a little surreal, honestly, thinking that it was just 1 year ago. Carol and I were just talking about it. It feels like another epoch. But to go back to it, you know, it was really this moment across corporate America, and certainly across the financial industry, which is what I write about, where we saw some of the biggest companies in the world saying, you know, we get it, and we're not going to stand by. We're going to play a role in fixing and healing systemic racism. And what the banks all did is a couple of things. One is that they pledged a lot of money. They pledged a lot of money, and they also said, here are some concrete things we're going to do.
What does it mean when they pledge? Like, what did they pledge money to?
Oh, huge, huge amounts. You know, we saw things like, to stick to this subject, things like big scholarships to historically black schools. Okay. And that's the subject today that I'm writing about. So one of the big concrete things, Carol, is that they said, we're going to support historically black colleges and universities. There are about 100 of them. Mm-hmm. Listeners might recognize names like Howard, Spelman, but there are dozens and dozens of them across America, a really sort of interesting, rich source of young black talent for decades. And what our story is about, I tracked the data to take a look at how the big banks are doing when it comes to recruiting from these schools.
And how sounds like they're not doing so well.
Well, look, I mean, I think it's important to give credit to where it's due. And, you know, Goldman Sachs, for example, have a lot more interns this year than last year when it comes to HBCUs. And that's great, almost doubling.
But as you point out, internships are only part of the story.
That is right. So if internship is the good news, the slower progress for Goldman, and it's a good metaphor for the industry as well, you know, they went from having, I think, something along the lines of 22 HBCU hires, mm-hmm. and then they, you know, it's up, but only to 25. Now, you know, their goal is to double recruitment. And, you know, I would say the closest thing I got to bleak news while reporting the story was that at JP Morgan, HBCU recruitment actually fell from 1 year to the next. But I think another important piece of context is that when you look at all kinds of campuses, not just historically black colleges, the numbers of black recruits did go up at JP Morgan.
So net-net, is there a net-net in terms of are they doing better? They're just not going fast enough? And I'm curious what the firms tell you about this process.
The sense that I got from speaking to students and from speaking to banks was, you know, it's actually two different things. Let's separate them out because it's interesting. From the banks, what I heard was, look, this is going to take a long time. We truly care about it. And we're happy to be making progress, even if it's so far slow. And I think it's also important to remember that because of recruiting schedules, if they started big programs after George Floyd's murder, it's probably fair to be a little patient and see what happens next year with those numbers. But you know that Bloomberg News will be on it and will be trying to figure out if those numbers are not going up. But let's talk about those students, what I heard from students, because I had a really interesting time talking to, for example, young women at Spelman who, you know, want to be part of changing this industry.
What did they tell you?
Well, I would say there's a certain enthusiasm where they really like finance and they want to help cultivate black wealth. But I think there's also a sense that, you know, they are not naive, that they recognize that they will be walking into offices that are not like college for them,
yeah.
where the faces around them and the faces above them don't necessarily look like theirs.
Right.
Well, go ahead, Carol.
Well, and you mentioned Spellman, so you're talking about Alex Jenkins.
Alex Jenkins. She was great. But, you know, I think I might have spoken to maybe half a dozen young women at Spellman, Anissa Thomas as well. They, you know, I think really consistently, they really enjoyed getting to know Wall Street. Goldman Sachs had a competition for HBCUs called Market Madness. They all were super enthusiastic about.
Right.
And, you know, as you pointed out, it's a really important point. They need to get into the door through internships, and then they need to get hired. But the next big piece of the puzzle is retention.
I was just going to bring that point up. What are the companies that you speak to doing about retention?
It's a complicated question. I think the banks know about it,
right.
You know, and I think the students realize it. I think the students realize that when they get in there, it's going to take real thoughtfulness for how to build careers in an industry where, you know, realistically, the top executives of these banks, just like top executives of a lot of American companies, mostly white and mostly male, but the banks say that they understand and they're working on programs to keep them. You know, I want to mention someone really interesting I met named Angel Kasten. She was a mentor for that Market Madness program that I mentioned, and she's an HBCU graduate herself. But, you know, by the end of that competition, she had basically left the firm, I think. I think it was sometime around this year. She said to me, look, I was burned out on Wall Street culture. And I think that fixing this problem is going to take a lot of time. But the banks that I talked to said that they know that and that they're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, well, I like you said, the numbers tell the story in a big way, and I know you guys will be continuing to track it. Max, thank you so much. Really appreciate you bringing the story. Max Abelson, he's finance reporter at Bloomberg News. Check out his work on Twitter at Max Abelson. You can also check it out at Bloomberg.com.
Yeah, the story's called Wall Street Moving Slowly on Road to Recruit from Black Colleges. It's on Bloomberg.com and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal as well.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. From Bloomberg Radio.
So this week, it's a special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine's deep, deep dive into the world's cities, looking around the globe through several different lenses. It's a great summer read, and we're going to get an overview of that issue.
And joining us now is Amanda Colson Hurley, politics editor at Bloomberg Business Week. She's joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. We got a handful of stories that we want to get to. The one that I really want to start with, Amanda, it's the cover this week, and it's all about Mark Lori's desire to build a utopian megapolis in
say
the
that
American
five times
West.
Fast.
Well, I probably didn't even say it correctly, but 5 million
it's a
people,
tough one.
5 million people somewhere in the American West, a Georgian utopia. Take us into what Lori wants to do. This is the guy who founded diapers.com and sold it to Amazon for hundreds of millions of dollars and then sold jet.com a few years ago to Walmart for
hate these
billions
underachievers,
of dollars.
You know,
I know.
Amanda?
What? Yeah. He's a successful guy.
Yeah. So this is a great cover story and just a great story about how Lori, like a lot of other people in the tech world, has gotten the city building or city planning bug, and really has this vision of not only building this city from scratch that would eventually have 5 million people, but structuring it on the economic ideas of Henry George, who was a thinker in the 19th century. And in the process, the city, in Lori's vision, would kind of save capitalism from itself. It would, reduce inequality and produce a society, an egalitarian society. He's not, and he admits in the story, you know, he's not super clear on the details yet, still working through a lot about how this city would be governed, even where it would be located. They're looking at sites in the American West, but it's not even clear what state it would be in.
I got to tell you.
He's hired a team and an architect, and he's pretty serious about it, yeah.
Okay, well, I got one word as a Californian. Water. That is the challenge right now in the American West. It's sadly, but it's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the beginning of all of the issues that, you know, he would have to grapple with, if and when, his team actually decides on a site and really starts to get down to the brass tacks of planning. I think that we can kind of put this plan in the context of I think a lot of other efforts toward, hacking the city or building a better city, using technology and innovative ideas that have come out of Silicon Valley. A lot of them have run into roadblocks, I think, that proved more complicated than initially expected. I'm thinking of the Quayside plan in Toronto by Alphabet, I believe, that was scuppered not that long ago.
So. Well, Amanda, I think we talk about the importance of public-private partnerships. This feels like a public-private partnership, ultimately on steroids, leaning more towards the private. So it's curious. We'll have to see where it goes. In the meantime, when you talk about cities, you got to talk about China, and you got to talk about those ghost cities, which for a long time, a lot of folks who were short China, specifically because some of those ghost cities, are they really as deserted as we all have believed them to be, or maybe that's not the case?
Well, that's the question that led us to do some reporting because, we all remembered, especially about, 7-8 years ago, there was a whole wave of coverage in Western media of these ghost cities. A lot of viral photos online of these empty apartment towers. And the implication always was that, China has really made a mistake here. These places are overbuilt. If you build it, people won't come, right? That's not enough. And our reporters went and found, these places are not all booming metropolises, but people are moving in. They are coming to life. And in some cases, Bloomberg reporters had actually visited these same cities a number of years ago, so they were returning and were able to kind of compare their experiences to their earlier visits and found that things were much more lively. There were more private businesses, just more people around, families strolling in the square, kids playing, small businesses taking root. So I think these ghost cities, some of them might not quite meet the original goals that they had been built with, but these are not ghost towns by any means.
Well, and you do think about President Xi, his common prosperity, if he's looking to maybe bring more people from the rural areas into the cities, that ultimately they could be populated as he tries to kind of boost everybody economically. So it feels like it's a still stay tuned to see what ultimately happens.
Definitely. Yeah, as urbanization increases in China, presumably there's still a large and growing pool of future residents of these cities.
This one hit really close to home, a third story that I want to talk about in the cities issue.
Could tuning you turn into off the city, please?
I know. Sometimes I'm on the phone with my parents or something or friends, and I'm like, I got to just call you back because there's an ambulance right here. There's a highway right here. There's some person screaming right here.
The normal noise, din.
How do you make cities quieter and therefore increase quality of life? Because people want to live in them, sometimes regardless of how loud they are.
Yeah, that's right. And this we have this great essay in the issue about sound in cities, and it kind of starts with the fact that cities did get somewhat quieter during the pandemic, and yet noise complaints, largely did not decrease, which tells you something, right? In that a lot of the time people weren't commuting into work, they were staying at home. And then their neighbor turns on a leaf blower or something, and you think, okay, it's going to be so much quieter in the suburbs or, in a residential neighborhood than in Times Square. And that's not really the case, or perhaps it's quieter, but, that neighborhood noise is every bit as annoying, if not more so. So our writer, Fergus O'Sullivan, try to kind of dive into what it is about urban noise that bothers us or pleases us the most, and kind of found that, often it's not just about the volume. It's about the kind of overall effect. It varies a lot from place to place. What might be considered pleasant or annoying in China, might not be the same in Phoenix. And he kind of talks about the importance, too, of layering sounds instead of you're never going to get rid of urban noise. But
right.
You can do things to make it more pleasant.
Well, it's a great read. I got to say it. When it gets too quiet in my city, I get a little nervous. I like a little bit of noise. Amanda Coulson Hurley, politics editor at Business Week. It's the issue this week. It is all about cities. Check it out. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm going to try maybe channel an SNL skit. No, I'm not, because I'm really bad at this. But calling all you pot smokers. Can I do that?
I think you can. But this, you know, this story, it's a story about Amazon. It's also a story about
it's a rallying cry, Tim Stenovic. Come on. Just lean in on this.
I love this story. I was emailing with Spencer Soper a little earlier. And the fact of the matter is it is a really important story about the tension between supply and demand when it comes to labor market right now. Something that we've been talking about all week.
Tension? Maybe you should have a joint.
Wow, you're just going all in.
I'm just going all in.
She's going all in.
All right, let's bring in Spencer Soper. He's our Bloomberg News technology and e-commerce reporter. He wrote this story. He's on the phone in Seattle. Man, when this story crossed, we were all just talking about it in the newsroom. Spencer, it's good to have you here.
How early is too early to call Spencer on the West Coast to just get him on the radio so we can talk to him about this?
Are you awake?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I haven't been downwind of any Amazon vans, so I'm good.
Okay, we just need you for a few minutes to tell the story, and then you can go off and do whatever you want. So what's going on with Amazon?
Yeah, well, so Amazon stopped screening for marijuana, you know, for its own workers back in June. It made that announcement, and what's happening now is, you know, we're heading into This is the time of year when Amazon and its delivery partners prepare for the peak holiday season. They're doing lots of hiring and that sort of thing. And these delivery partners, these are small businesses that deliver Amazon packages in those blue vans people see in all their neighborhoods. They're having a really hard time finding workers, just, you know, recruiting people, getting them to take the jobs, getting them to stay once they're hired. And so Amazon's advice to them is, you know, recruit pot smokers. So if you prominently advertise in your job listings that you don't screen for marijuana, Amazon's advising them that they could see the number of applications they receive rise by as much as 400%, which sounds very, you know, like a really big number. Mm-hmm. And that if they do screen for marijuana, they're going to cut the prospective worker pool by up to 30%. So it's a clear sign that Amazon's, you know, trying to encourage these business partners to get with the times and follow the trend of legalization of marijuana around the country. It's recreational marijuana use is legal in about 20 states, including a lot of big ones like California, New York, that sort of thing. Still illegal in a lot of states, so that's what makes some of these delivery businesses a little bit wary about taking this step.
So is Amazon telling its delivery partners that even in states where it's not recreationally legal, that they still shouldn't? They shouldn't say they're going to screen for this?
Yeah, the advice has gone out pretty universally, and I guess in fairness, you know, you might live in a state next to a state where it's legal, or even take a trip to somewhere where it's legal, because marijuana can really linger in your system for a long time, long after your impairment is diminished, you know. So even after you, you know, regain all your faculties and are safe to drive, you're still going to have traces of marijuana in your system. And so that's really the point that they're making. But that's a very good point in terms of the delivery providers that operate in states where it's illegal. They're very worried if they have a driver in a crash with injuries or that kills somebody or something, and they test positive for marijuana, that they're going to face a lot of questions from a lawyer about their job screening process.
Right. That, as you have a quote in the story, that's their problem, right? Not Amazon's, if that happens.
Yeah, because these companies are employing the drivers themselves, not Amazon. So Amazon dictates all kinds of things, but there is a liability layer there in the sense that these people are employees of a separate company.
We're having some fun with you, Spencer, about it, because it's just, you know, the headline on it is great. But, I mean, Amazon's got to be thinking about the holiday season already and making sure that they've got enough drivers in what we know is always a busy season for them.
Yeah, I mean, finding enough people is always a challenge for Amazon. Mm. And then it just became intensified during the pandemic when, you know, we just saw so much spending shift online, and a lot of that is lingering. Even though growth is slowing, it's still staying there. It's not really peeling back. So it's going to be another tough year just for Amazon to find enough bodies to meet demand. And this is one way to just expand the labor pool. It's kind of like, all right, let's look at the supply side of this, and you know, not screening for marijuana is a good way to increase the supply.
Hey, Spencer, I was thinking about this the other day because I sent a package to a friend of mine across the country using a, you know, traditional delivery service. It was $14 and it was a tiny package. And I thought to myself, wow, how is Amazon able to send me packages from all over the country or from distribution centers in the same day close to my apartment for free? How much are these drivers making?
A lot of these drivers, it'll vary by geography, obviously, but, you know, at least 15 an hour, you know, and it seems like the average seems to fall somewhere around 17, you know, maybe okay. A little more like 18, 19 in high cost areas and a little less in lower cost areas. And then to your point, it's always been that way. Like you as a retail customer going in just to send one individual package, it's going to cost you a lot more money than a business that's got a constant stream of packages. You know, those, you're going to get, they get very big, you know, volume discounts, you know, from carriers. So you're always paying a lot more. Like what you paid to send one little thing is not representative at all of the cost of, you know, a big retailer shipping individual packages.
As you point out in your piece, I mean, Amazon increasingly doing this themselves, whether it's their own fleet of aircraft or this army of delivery drivers that they have that are independent contractors.
Yeah, they're taking on more and more on their own, and that's why they need to find more workers. And the counter here is that a lot of these delivery providers, what they're pleading with Amazon, saying we can't find people. Please pay us more so we can pay drivers more and get the bodies we need. And Amazon's answer is like, maybe forget all that. Just hire some pot smokers.
See,
that is the perfect summation of the story.
We got to end there. Spencer Soper, thank you so much. He is technology and e-commerce reporter at Bloomberg News, all things Amazon, on the phone from Seattle.
What? You know, I got to meet Spencer in person a few weeks ago when I was in Texas.
You guys were just like bros, right?
Oh, it was awesome. Yeah, it was awesome. I love being able to travel and meet colleagues from all over the country. People I've spoken to for a year, like interviewed on TV or on radio. Finally getting to hang out with him, we had a lot of fun.
He's a good guy, and his stuff when it comes to Amazon is always a must read, just kind of getting some great insight into what they are up to.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So Tim and I just talked for some of our audience about some of the COVID headlines that are out there. One that caught my attention is a majority of U.S. employers are planning or considering requirements for a COVID shot by year end. Tim, we continue to see momentum. And on that, we had a story today about Apple asking all U.S. employees to report their vaccination status.
Hey, send it to us. Tell us if you've gotten vaccinated and when you got vaccinated. It's increasingly something I think we're going to see more and more of, especially, Carol, as you and I were talking about during the break. Pfizer has received full approval for its 2-shot vaccine here. So I think companies like Delta, for example, are thinking differently about to what extent they can actually compel their employees in different ways.
Carrot and stick, right? We talked about that.
Yeah, that one's a stick.
All right, let's talk about the latest news when it comes to COVID and the vaccine. Dr. Rachel Evadu, she's co-founder and CEO of Modi Health, back with us on the phone from Los Angeles. Dr. Du, nice to have you back. Modi, for those who don't remember, platform that offers live telemedicine, telewellness consultations, and other tools when it comes to health and wellness. How are you? What's going on?
I'm wonderful, Carol. Nice to be back with you and Tim. Thanks for having me again. I'm doing fantastic.
It's really good to have you back with us, Dr. Du. Since we last spoke, what are you seeing in terms of vaccine uptake from people who are in touch with your practice? Is it pretty widespread that people are getting vaccinated?
Absolutely. Now, at Modi Health, we're a community of integrative specialists, and what we're really seeing as the pandemic continues and more people continue to get vaccinated is that there's a significant increase in interest in preventative care and also people's desire to proactively prevent illness and increase health, even on the other side of vaccines. And really the most common question we're getting right now is, how can I support my immune system better?
How can you? Tell us, share. We all want to know.
Absolutely. Sure. We suggest keeping your immunity healthy and really a top priority with reducing stress, increasing healthy nutrition and daily exercise, as well as reducing things that negatively impact the immune system. things like poor sleep hygiene, processed foods, alcohol intake, and refined sugar. So those are a few easy steps you can take.
Okay. Easy is in the, you know, eye of the beholder, right?
Tim and I are like looking don't got that.
Yeah, sleep, nope. Easier said than done. Carol and I were just talking about one of the breaks, like how we monitor sleep, because we were talking about the Apple Watch that's coming out. But let's start with just something that people can control, or I think that people don't think they can control very well. And that was the first thing that you said, which is stress. What is the advice that you have for people who are just kind of overwhelmed with the way things are right now? How do they take a step back and try to reduce that stress so their immune system is not affected?
Beautiful question. I think the first step is really acknowledging that this has been a really stressful time, and the impacts, even unconsciously, of all of the media, all of the experiences, all of the shifts in social connection or transitions we've made in the workplace during the pandemic have definitely led to stress, whether you're aware of it or not. So the first thing is really acknowledging that, yes, there is an increase in stress, and just allowing yourself space and time to process that. Maybe that's taking, you know, 15-minute break to just step outside and take some deep breaths, or scheduling in a little extra self-care time or relaxation. But really acknowledging and creating the space to address that stress is a priority.
I do also wonder how we need to kind of think about how we do our own self-care when it comes to checkups and monitoring of our actual physical health, right? If you're good, right, you hopefully once a year go get a physical and you check everything out. You go to the eye doctor, you are good with the dental work and all that kind of thing. You guys have a concierge membership, and I'm just curious how you are thinking about healthcare and how best to help people really keep on top of their wellness so that they don't get sick.
Absolutely. I think we're starting to see that shift being more prevalent now, from the concept of sick care to well care. And, you know, the World Health Organization really defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not just, you know, the absence of disease or infirmity. So whole person healthcare is both a holistic and integrative approach that looks at the whole person, identifies the root cause of illness, and really supports healing as a way of, you know, preventative wellness measures. And that does not only just limit you getting sick and having health crises, but really increases and optimizes your health and well-being. So that's what our concierge health membership really focuses on.
Give us a percentage of how much you can do over telehealth versus in person with us.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's important to know that telehealth should not fully replace in-person care. There's a beautiful marriage of the two. Getting diagnostic lab work is still critically important. Having physical hands-on exams are still important. And those typically during well care or your prevention can absolutely be things like Carol mentioned about your once a year physical lab work, things of that nature. But primarily the rest of your care, your more holistic care and treatment, mm-hmm. ongoing preventative wellness, check-ins, checkups, mental health, wellness, life coaching, health coaching, all of those things can be done very effectively via telemedicine and telewellness sessions.
Yeah, it just sounds like it's another thing that we just have to kind of regularly have, like you go to get a massage or something, like just kind of work it into.
I want to get a regular massage.
I know. I keep saying that. Here I am a year and a half later. Dr. Du, thank you so much. Dr. Rachel Du, she's board certified doctor of natural medicine, chief executive officer, co-founder of Modi Health, with us on the phone from Los Angeles. Put that on your to-do list.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you gotten one?
Not since the pandemic.
I know, right?
Yeah, we got to reduce that stress. That's the way I can do it.
Okay, we got to work on that.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everyone. 10.5 minutes left in today's trading session. Bouncing around, as you mentioned, Tim, we're definitely off our highs of the session here.
Yeah, the Dow is lower. The S&P 500 is higher, but just fractionally right now by 0.6%. The NASDAQ higher, though, by 0.4%. The Russell, the leader of the pack.
Yeah, but listen, we have talked so much about the nonstop records when it comes to these major equity averages, even if we're seeing maybe a little bit of a pullback here today, certainly in the Dow. Let's get to it, though, with the Drive to the Close and Leo Kelly. He's founder, CEO, CIO over at Verdance Capital Advisors. They oversee about $3 billion in client assets, and he's with us on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland. Leo, how are you?
I'm well. Good to be with you guys again.
Well, what do you make of the market moves? It does feel like we were getting ready for the 54th record on the S&P 500.
Yes, if it closes at a record today, that would be 54.
Does it make sense to you?
It does, and it does because there's just so much liquidity and so much money flushing around the system. You really don't need a great boat if the wave is that big taking you to shore. It's just a massive liquidity cycle we're in.
How long, how big does that wave get, and how long does that wave last?
Well, I think there's an important variable, and that is valuation that you have to put into the mix. The wave, from an economic standpoint, is going to last. There's just so much money, and we still have two catalysts in front of us, and that is the recovery of supply, which is an incredible problem for the economy at the moment, and probably the one contributing factor to it not really blowing off a top. And the second is the return to employment for a lot of folks that are hesitant to get back in the workforce.
Let's start with recovery of supply first. And we're going to talk about employment in a minute because of Friday's jobs report. When you say recovery of supply, what supply were you referring to specifically?
It's all over the map, right? Whether we're talking about chips or we're talking
about supply chains, right?
Washing machine. We're talking about the entire supply chain, right? Everything is right now disrupted. And as that recovers, the economy has some more legs in it. And again, there's plenty of money out there. The consumer is healthy. The consumer is ready to buy. Their optimism has waned here recently, but that can recover pretty quickly.
There are some interesting things going out. You know, you do wonder, Leo, are we going to get to a point where because of the difficulties in the supply chain, we've already done the stories about chips, that could we eventually have a glut, you know, as these companies ramp up to meet these, you know, heightened demands and get more access to things. And so what does that mean maybe down the road? You talk about, you know, all the liquidity that's out there. There's lots of cash, or Gina Martin Adams talked about it. All of that cash has to go somewhere, and that's why you continue to see certainly support for U.S. equities in particular. How does it end? Do we know the end of this story or the end of this cycle yet?
Sure, we know the end. It ends badly.
Oh.
We know the end because it's happened so many times before. What we don't know is how many pages the book is. So the challenge with an event like this, will we get a supply glut? Of course, because the natural force of greed is going to ramp up supply significantly, and there'll be plenty of demand to support that. We'll see valuations and equities continue to climb as earnings do extraordinarily well next year as a result of all this. And sooner or later, enthusiasm exceeds reality. Mm-hmm. And price has a blow off top, and that never ends well. But the challenge as an investor is that these things can go much higher than expectations or reason. They go much lower than expectations or reason when things are bad. And so it is to maintain one's head in their process of allocating assets.
I want to come back to that, and before we come back to that, I want to hit on what you said about the second element of the catalyst that we're talking about, the return to employment. We are expecting the August jobs report coming at 8:30 on Friday morning. What do you think? When do you think we'll see full employment again? Do you think we'll see people go back to the workforce the same way that they left the workforce, like to that same extent?
Yes, I do, and every new paradigm is usually debunked with time.
Huh.
Because we get these anomalies in the market. Now, I will say this. this is probably one of the greatest anomalies of all time. To shut down a multi-trillion-dollar economy through an artificial means in an abrupt fashion, and then to turn that economy back on through trillions of dollars of liquidity, both fiscally and monetarily, thrown into the system, which was matched by pretty much every country in the world, is going to create enormous anomalies, a.k.a. a 1.3% treasury with inflation and GDP growth like we're seeing today. It should be 5% based on those numbers. So, yes, employment will come back. What we need is quote-unquote normalcy, right? Kids back in school.
Yeah.
We need these extra unemployment benefits to slowly find their way out of the system.
Leo, it's so interesting what you said about the early unemployment benefits, because there is an article today in the Wall Street Journal by Danny Doherty and Sarah Cheney Cambin that said that states that cut unemployment benefits, they saw limited impact on job growth. There are a lot of caveats here that it could be too early to tell, but we didn't quite see the surge in people returning to the workforce in states that had cut off the access to unemployment benefits.
Yeah, there's data that will argue different points, right, based on which data measure you're looking at. I try to take a long-term point of view because that's how I invest. I'm not a trader. And so when we look at a long-term point of view, in the end, human beings are motivated to go to work for two reasons, to create purpose in their lives and to create income for their families, right, to create a means of sustenance. And so that can't be replaced just with benefits. And so as the economy continues to stay heated and there's money in the system and pay goes up, which, by the way, makes inflation something other than transitory, which is another issue, you start to pull folks back into work. And so if the pay goes down to stay home versus the increase in wages that's coming and has happened to go back to work, and it gives people purpose, things start to go back to whatever normal is. So it's a matter of time more than it is if it's going to happen or not.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Leo, good to have you here, and great to get your thoughts in terms of the trade. Leo Kelly, he's founder, chief executive officer, chief investment officer at Vertice Capital Advisors.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.